Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Tongue is about to books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sawbones Marital Tour of Misguided Medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy. You okay there, Justin?
Sid, jet lag. I'm jet lag. I was out on the West Coast.
Jet lag. It's so tough. Flying back and forth across the country doing shows.
There is nothing more exhausting than jet lag, except maybe watching our children without me around.
except solo parenting, running the household, going to work, taking care of a sick kid. She's okay now, by the way.
Thank you. Where were you all when she was sick, though? That's my question.
Where were you when I needed amoxicillin for an ear infection? Not me, but our child. Anyway, all is well. Justin, we're not talking about Burning Man this week. That is not what we're talking about.
That will be the first time since I've been back that you have not been talking about Burning Man. So imagine my surprise.
I do want to say, I feel like for posterity, I want to get this on the record, that I feel like there's probably a future episode that may come. If you're not following what's going on out at Burning Man, which is this, I don't even know. It's a big art festival, music art, whatever, Live Your Truth Festival out in the desert.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never been, but I've watched documentaries about it. But anyway, it rained and they're in this like ancient dried up lake bed that's made of like alkaline dust.
Yeah.
And then it rained, which I guess it like never does there. And so now it's this sort of mud that no one can move in. You can't walk in it. You can't drive cars in it. You can't ride bikes in it. So everybody's just kind of, there's like 70,000 people stuck there. Although I guess a lot of people have by now hiked out the 5 or 6 miles out in the mud to the road and to hitchhike back to like towns.
Every few minutes, Sydney will just be in another room and I'll hear, well, another truck got stuck.
It's wild to see. The reason it interests me from Sawbones, and this is why I think maybe there's a future episode here. So I'm going on the record. So this stuff isn't like regular mud. It's like a salt flat. It's really alkaline. It's the opposite of acidic, right? It's really basic. And it like the pH is 9 or 10 or something. So anyway, if you get it on your bare skin for long enough, it can cause kind of like chemical burns almost. Like it draws all the moisture out of your skin and you can get big cracks opening, right? Because your skin gets super dried out. And a bunch of people are walking around barefoot. And what I started looking up is what kind of bacteria specifically thrive in alkaline environments. Because there are bacteria, like we used to think, like most bacteria like neutral environments, you know, like the pH in the middle. Some like really acidic, some like really alkaline. The ones who like really alkaline that might survive out in those salt flats, now there's all these cracked open feet wandering around. There may be a really unfortunate but interesting episode of Sawbones.
Oh, gosh.
That's pending.
Grody, I gotta be honest.
No one at Burning Man can hear me because they're stuck there, but like, please don't walk around barefoot. Please don't moisturize a lot when you get home. So anyway, I just want to go on the record and say that because several people were like, have already actually emailed to say, is this a topic? And I'm not sure yet, but I'm digging into it.
If the amount of time Cindy is spending following the proceedings at Burning Man is any indication, she will find the topic.
I just thought it was regular desert. I didn't know it was a salt flat. That's a whole other. I just didn't know that. I missed that detail. Anyway, We are monitoring the situation closely here at Sawbones.
Here at the HQ, we got the news desk is all over it.
Yeah. I hope everyone's okay. I do not wish anyone ill will. I'm sorry that I'm fascinated by it because that makes it seem like I'm detached and inhuman. I do hope everyone is okay.
Yeah, you would hope that goes without saying, but yeah, now you've said it. So
I do
no
not want anyone
there.
To suffer, but I am watching to see what will happen. We're not talking about that. There was another issue. There was a lot of discourse on TikTok about this past week. And Justin, probably not on yours. I get a lot of like medical TikTok. Some of it is because I've messed up my algorithm permanently for all of you. Some of it is like fake medicine, TikTok stuff. And then other is like people calling out fake medicine stuff. I get a lot of that, which is always interesting because then it kind of alerts me to something new and weird that's out there. And there has been this discourse about the oral glucose tolerance test.
Yes. I remember lately. That.
Yes. The idea being that, and if you've ever been pregnant or if you're familiar with this test from a healthcare perspective or because you know somebody who's been pregnant, basically it's a, and I'm going to walk you through it, but it's a test we do to look to see if somebody has or is at risk for gestational diabetes, meaning developing diabetes while pregnant.
I remember this test because you thought it was really gross.
Yes.
The stuff that you had to drink, it yucked you out.
Yes. And right now the discourse is calling into question both the need for the test and then the method that we use to perform it, specifically how we go about it and if it's really necessary.
Okay.
Just to walk you through it real quick before I tell you why it is necessary and why we do it the way we do it, because that's my thesis statement.
Right. Not to spoil it.
Yes. Let me just say that at the beginning. So if you have certain risk factors, this can be a little different. We screen you, first of all, based on history. Like, when do you need to have this test done and will you have one or two tests and all this stuff? And then the other part is like what your result is from the test, whether or not you have another one done.
Right.
Just to kind of give you an example, our first child was really big.
I mean, and there it is. There's no nice way of saying it was a big baby.
She was a big baby. So big that we ended up with a C-section. And so my second pregnancy, my doctor decided to go ahead and screen me earlier for gestational diabetes based on the idea that even though my test during my, I got all my screening in my first pregnancy, I followed all the rules, but it said I didn't have it. But then he was kind of like, I don't know, did we miss it? Your baby was really big. Maybe we should check, put you in a higher risk category basically and stratify you a little differently based on that. And I still tested negative, so I still didn't have it. I still did have another very large child, so I just have large children. They were
big.
Both over 9 pounds, honey. Yeah, those are big babies. Big babies. Anyway, so when you're having the test done, the regular 1 hour glucose tolerance test, this is what everybody is going to have done. If your doctor orders it, you should have it done between 24 and 28 weeks of pregnancy. Basically, the morning of the test, you go to the lab, you drink a glucola solution. So it's specifically a solution made of 50 grams of glucose. There are different kinds of sugar, right? There's fructose and sucrose, and there's all kinds of sugars. Glucose is what you drink in this test.
Yes.
Okay. It is
O's.
The one that
are
I
the sugars, right? O's.
O's. Right. Yep. The one that I drank was orange. I think there are other flavors. I did not enjoy it. I've never heard anybody say like loved that glucola. It's an incredibly sweet. It's just sugar. It's just pure sugar.
Our kids would probably
orange
like
sugar.
It.
Oh, our kids would love it. I found it difficult because I also was a little nauseous that morning, and so you know it's unpleasant. But anyway, after 60 minutes, they check your blood glucose level. They have like an expectation that your body should be able to tolerate that glucose load, like get it out of your bloodstream and into cells where it can be used for energy. And so if that level is under 140, and this cutoff, by the way, can vary a little bit from doctor to doctor. Like if you go to a different medical institution, you might find them say 135. There's a little bit of variability there. But generally speaking, if the level's under 140, then your body handled glucose the way we expect it to. If it's over that, then you may have gestational diabetes and we need to do further testing. And then further testing is a 3 hour glucose tolerance test, which is very, very similar, except for you drink the first, they bring you in, they check your fasting blood sugar, meaning no food. Then you drink the stuff, And then they check it at 1 hour, 2 hours, and 3 hours. And they have cutoffs for all of those. What should a fasting blood sugar be? What should a 1 hour, a 2 hour, and a 3 hour?
Got it.
Right? Okay. Same idea, except for that one was 100 grams of glucose. But same idea. All of this, along with, you know, an appropriate history and physical exam and everything, can help your doctor decide if you have gestational diabetes, and then can help you manage it if you do. Right? We've talked about diabetes before, and I'm not going to get into, like, because we have a whole episode on diabetes and how we have known about diabetes since ancient times. We have described things that we now call diabetes mellitus.
An old one.
Yes. Gestational diabetes is a little more recent, and I think it's important to talk about how we figured it out because it helps us answer the question. Let's say that you listen to some of these people on TikTok who are urging you either not to get the glucose tolerance test or to do it your own way. That's what I'm starting to see, are people who are saying, like, one, you just shouldn't do it. It's unnecessary. And this is like a nuanced topic. They're accusing doctors of medicalizing birth unnecessarily. We're intervening with something that is a natural process and we should leave it be. And to some degree, I understand that concern. Having gone through two pregnancies, there are a lot of times where you just feel like, oh my gosh, why are we, like, why do I, the birthing process, why do I have to be strapped to a bed on monitors on my back if things are progressing as expected and there are no complications? And so there are lots of, like, ways we could debate different aspects of the way we manage pregnancy and birth and why it's different all over the world. And outcomes are different in different countries, and we don't always necessarily do things the best way here. Sure, there's lots of room for that conversation.
Yeah.
When it comes to the glucose tolerance test and diagnosing diabetes, the reason we do that is that prior to our ability to diagnose and treat gestational diabetes, a lot of people died. It's just that simple. The outcomes before were really bad. Once we were able to appropriately risk stratify, diagnose, and treat people, the outcomes improved. This really isn't one of those areas. There is a lot of debate as to the exact threshold and when to test and who to test at what week. Like, we could get into all that. But the idea that it is important to diagnose and treat this is not debatable.
Right.
And trying to replace that glucola because it tastes so bad with, like, I've seen, like, fruit drinks and Cokes and smoothies.
It doesn't make sense because it has to be a certain amount of sugar for a test to work, right? It can't just be like something sugary. It has to be an exact amount of sugar, right?
Yes. And it also is proposing that there is something inherently dangerous about the sugar glucose.
Yes.
Which is not. And then, of course, the other, like, thing they'll throw in there is, and it's got a food dye in it, which, like, mine was orange. So fair. I am assuming.
Yes.
Yes. There was a food dye in it. But it's playing on this idea that food dyes are inherently bad. And we've done a whole episode before about how, like, we don't have proof that artificial food dyes are inherently bad, generally speaking. Like, we have talked about specific issues. Generally speaking, they're not. So when did we first figure out gestational diabetes? I mean, because you got to imagine, like, there have always been big babies. There have always been babies that were larger.
I'm proof of that, right? No matter how far back you go.
Yes. It's weird then when you think about the fact that not only would there have always been larger babies, but if, like, in my case, my doc was very clear with us that our firstborn was not coming out in a vaginal delivery. This was not going to happen.
If you had been alive in the 17 or 1800s, this baby would just end up macerated inside of you. I remember he said that to us.
And then you would become septic and die. That is what he told us.
Message received.
By the way, I will say, like, I know that sounds like a really shocking thing.
He's like the dude. Like, this guy's the goat.
He delivered me.
Yeah, I mean, he knows what he's talking about.
He was an incredible doctor. And part of why he was talking to me that way is because I am also a physician. He knows me very well. He not only delivered me and was my doctor and delivered our oldest, he also trained me in medical school.
Yeah, he doesn't sugarcoating.
No, and he knew that I understood and I was being resistant because I had a certain idea of how I wanted everything to go, and of course, the best laid plans. But anyway,
it was all for
the best. Everyone came out fine.
Yeah, all good.
That's true, and I'm sure that happened. And it's weird then that 1824 is when we get like the first report.
Yeah.
Of a large baby. And like that kind of started to clue people in, like maybe we could look at certain things that predispose pregnant people to giving birth to these very large children that pose, like especially in our prior to anesthesia and, you know, a sterile OR and all that kind of stuff, prior to our ability to safely do a C-section, if you can't get the baby out vaginally, that's catastrophic. That's what we were looking at, was a catastrophic fatal event.
These are catastrophically
patient and child.
These are catastrophically chunky babies.
Yes.
As a catastrophically chunky baby myself, clocking in at a vivacious 11 pounds at birth, I understand the threat that we pose, and I know that we cannot go unstopped. You can't let us big babies run around unchecked.
Dr. Heinrich Gottlieb Benowitz.
Don't start me on that guy. We all talk about him at the big baby meetings.
At the University of Berlin, he wrote up a case report. And this was when, like, we see, again, I'm sure there were big babies. But
there have always been since the beginning of time immemorial big babies.
We're linking it to, he wrote up a case of a 22-year-old woman, Frederica Pape, who during her pregnancy, this was her fifth pregnancy, she had gone to her doctor complaining of, she was thirsty all the time. She could not stop drinking fluids. She was constantly thirsty. And we've talked about the idea of like studying urine on this show many times. We've talked about the urine color and flavor wheel. Remember that?
Yes.
You can go and you can diagnose lots of things by the smell, color, and
taste of urine.
And specifically, she had cloudy, stale-smelling urine throughout her pregnancy. And then when it came to time to give birth, she had a what was described as Herculean 12-pound baby.
Yeah.
That's even bigger than you, Justin. Even bigger than you.
It's not about that. It's just about being a big baby, honey. It's not about comparing specific carriages.
And this is when you first start to see this, like, this connection between, okay, there's some symptoms and some things that are happening during pregnancy. And we can see, like, the patient is reporting stuff to us that they're observing. And then the urine is a signal there's something else there.
Okay.
And then we have this big baby, which, of course, poses a problem for us.
Listen, we've been very clear about that, where we stand on big babies.
And this was really like, and this was just one, and there were several case reports that he wrote up, but this really laid the groundwork for throughout the 1800s, us beginning to understand and establish like there is some sort of diabetic state that happens during pregnancy, and we're not sure who's going to get it, but we probably need to figure out how. And so I'm going to talk to you about the development of that test, but first we got to go to the billing department.
Let's go. The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth. I have really enjoyed experimenting with fashion, thanks to Quince. Now, I know that that sounds wild coming from me, Justin McElroy, a podcaster. Why, Justin, are you even wearing clothes? I hear you. But when I want to try a new look, what I love about Quince is they have a lot of different clothing items that are at a great price and are really well made. So if you want to try something, you're not sure if it's like, is this going to be the right fit for me? I don't know. Try it out with Quince. There's craftsmanship that you see in every detail of these clothes. I've bought several, like a pair of shorts I love, a pair of pants I wear literally every day. I mean, nearly every day, not literally every day. You know what I mean? Because there's some days you're just like, you can't. But I've been so happy with the pieces that we have gotten from Quince. And also there's a really wide variety of stuff. You know, there's silk tops, skirts for dressing up, denim for everyday wear. I don't mention a lot of the specific items because honestly, you shouldn't trust me about that part of it if it's outside my specific range of clothes for my body. But I will say this, for my body, Quince does right.
sounds weird now that I say it like that. Find gifts so good you'll want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/sawbones for free shipping on your order. 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/sawbones to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/sawbones. You know, it's tempting to say, I'm going to start on the big new thing. You know, when the new year comes, I'm going to get it all figured out. Here's what I want to tell you. There's never been a better time to start your dream than right this second. And there's never been a better way to start than with Squarespace. We've been telling you about Squarespace for years, and that's because it's simply the best way to make a website. I mean, there's no other way to put it than that, folks. People have been using Squarespace to make incredible professional-looking websites. And they look professional because the templates they're using, they are made by real web designers. So they're making, like, building blocks that are going to look great. You just bring your stuff, your images, your things you want to sell, any of that, and Squarespace is going to help you make a great platform for it. Head to squarespace.com/sawbones for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code SAWBONES to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Somewhere in an alternate universe where Hollywood is smarter.
And the Emmy nominees for Outstanding Comedy Series are Jetpacula, Airport Marriott, Threpple, Dear America, We've Seen You Naked, and Allah in the Family.
In our stupid universe, you can't see any of these shows, but you can listen to them on Dead Pilot Society, the podcast that brings you hilarious comedy pilots that the networks and streamers bought but never made. Journey to the alternate television universe of Dead Pilot Society on MaximumFun.org.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Bullseye is celebrating 50 years of hip-hop by bringing you an entire month of brand new interviews with rappers. That means Jeezy.
I put my pain in the music.
Angie Stone.
You know, hip-hops. We called them hops back then.
Master P.
Music is what's gonna open the doors for us, but whatever we come up with after this, it's gonna be bigger.
Plus, Chica, Saba, even the greatest of them all, Rakim. That's this September. Open up that podcast app, type in Bullseye, and hit subscribe. You're not gonna want to miss any of this.
Is it weird that I really want to try some of that goop now?
It's so gross.
Yeah.
So it's sickeningly sweet.
Yeah.
Like,
could they put it in a snow cone for you?
You just have to eat it really fast.
I guess so, yeah. And it would dilute it, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to just get it down all at once. Like, it's about how your body tolerates the load.
Right. I gotcha. So where were we, Sid?
Okay. So we're in the late 1800s. And based on these early observations and the fact that, like, we were able at least at this point to take these urine samples that we knew smelled a certain way. And again, like, we're not too far removed from the time when people would, like, dip a pinky and taste a drop.
Yeah.
Because that used to happen. And say, this urine is sweet. It's sweet. Mm-hmm. There's sugar in it.
Sorry.
There's sugar coming out of this human into their pee.
You got a big baby brewing.
And we already knew that sugar in your urine was connected with diabetes. Because we already knew about diabetes at this point, right? Like, right. This was an entity. And now we're saying, okay, we have this person who before becoming pregnant, pee was normal. During pregnancy.
Sweet pee.
Sweet pee. And so you get all of these sort of like a special unit was established in Scotland by James Matthews Duncan, who started like to study these specific patients with these symptoms and monitor like what happens with these very various diabetic patients, what is the outcome in their pregnancy. And what he was seeing is that from all of this, like he wrote up all of these observations, and this sort of underlines why we do this today. He saw that specifically, if you had this constellation of really thirsty pregnant people mm-hmm. with this cloudy urine, and they have sugar in their urine, they figured out, they get these big babies, and the mortality rates were like 60% for the pregnant people and 47% for the babies.
Wow.
So very, very high. And all of this was published in journals in the late 1800s to kind of underline, we need to figure out a screening test. But at that point, part of the reason there wasn't this big rush to figure out, like, okay, how can we tease out the people who have gestational diabetes from those who don't, is because we still didn't have a great treatment for diabetes yet.
So it's like highlighting it didn't make much sense.
Yeah, like what are we going to, other than knowing this could be catastrophic, like, I don't know, you know, like you look at a pregnant person and say, okay, I can tell you from this constellation of things that you are very likely to have a giant baby that your pelvis cannot deliver. We are just at the point where we can maybe do C-sections. Maybe.
Maybe.
But even then, like, not everyone has access to it. Not everybody can do it. So, what's the point?
We found some ways of finding the big babies before disaster struck, but didn't have a lot of great ways of getting the big babies out.
Yes. And well, but we also didn't have a great way of managing gestational diabetes.
Oh, right.
Because that can prevent
the parent
having a giant baby. And there are other complications. I'm focusing on the size of the baby because you like to talk about that. But there are other, like, part of what can happen in babies that are born to people with gestational diabetes that isn't controlled, mm-hmm. is that immediately after they're born, their bodies will, because they've been processing all this extra sugar from the pregnant, you know, parent, their bodies will be producing all this insulin, but all that extra sugar isn't coming in anymore because now they're outside.
Right.
They become severely hypoglycemic, meaning low blood sugar.
The inverse.
Yes. So it is very common, and this is another thing that people get upset about, when a baby is born to somebody who's diabetic, that they monitor their glucose levels.
You don't give them a bomb pop.
No, you don't give them a bomb pop. And also just large babies, if you remember, ours were. All babies get their sugar checked. Large babies, babies born to diabetic parents, that you might have more monitoring, closer mm-hmm. monitoring.
Right.
Do you remember ours? Do you remember this happening? Our second?
Yeah.
She had her sugar was a little low.
Oh, yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
And I would have to, like, feed, and they would check again and make sure it was okay.
Yeah, that was wild.
Yeah. This is why we're avoiding catastrophe that used to happen. And then we discovered insulin. And we've talked about this extensively in our diabetes episode. In 1921 in Toronto, Banting and Best figured out how to get insulin from a dog's pancreas. And this was the beginning of our ability to manage diabetes and save lots of lives, right? Like, this wasn't just about gestational diabetes. Like, everybody with diabetes suddenly had a good way of managing it. We could give them the insulin that their body didn't have.
Yeah.
And save lives. I mean, because before that, that mortality rate from diabetes in general was very high. So we still need to figure out who's going to develop it. Okay, now we have insulin. Mm-hmm. We can use it in gestational diabetes.
Great.
How can we predict who's going to develop it so that we're not playing catch up, right?
Sweet pea.
And so it started with Dr. Priscilla White in 1949. She was working at the Joslin Clinic in Boston. And she came up with a system called White's classification. And this was used for a really long time. And basically, it was like an alphabetic list. And it was really patient history based. So they were looking, it would be based on an interview. There wasn't necessarily any tests to do or anything like that. It was just, I'm going to ask you some questions. And based on past pregnancies, based on your medical history, like, do you have high blood pressure? Obviously, have you been diagnosed with diabetes before? Family history, like, just stuff in the patient's history, they would give you a classification mm-hmm. that would risk stratify you as to, like, do we think you might develop diabetes
or not? Dr. House says everybody lies. I saw that on your show.
Well, that's true. But patient history-based it's good. Like, patient history-based screening is obviously critical in a lot of the decision-making we make in medicine. But the problem, too, is that gestational diabetes could affect people that you didn't necessarily predict.
Mm-hmm.
So there needed to be a nice standardized way to check at some point in pregnancy to just see if, like, are you developing this and there was no way we could have known?
I have an idea.
What's that?
What if I make them a super sweet goop and make them drink it?
Well, that's exactly what happened. In 1964.
I should mention, though, it's not for science. I just love making pregnant people drink super sweet goop. It's kind of my thing. But if it helps science, too, that's like an added perk.
I have to imagine the first people who tried this, like, were ready to throw it back in the researcher's face. Like, you know I'm pregnant and I feel like crap and you want me to drink this?
Well, maybe it was better then. Maybe they were using like Sprite syrup from the machine.
Probably wasn't dyed. Like, it probably wasn't. It
probably doesn't need to be dyed. We could probably meet halfway on that.
I always wondered, you know, that I don't know that point. Do you think like it looks more like a drink that I've had in my life? If it was just a clear glucose substance.
Oh, it's like drinking K-Ro syrup or something like
that.
Yeah,
it's not fizzy or anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like Kool-Aid.
Just getting thirstier and thirstier. We got to move on.
So John O'Sullivan and Claire Mahan invented originally the two-step oral glucose tolerance test. And when I say two-step, I mean like a 1 hour and a 3 hour. Those are the two steps.
Got it.
So they were the ones who first standardized and came up with, we'll give you 50 grams of glucose, and then we will check your blood glucose in an hour. And then, of course, in the second step, we check your sugar, 100 grams of glucose every hour for 3 hours. And the reason that we still use those amounts and those hour cutoffs and all that same criteria is because that's how they did the study. Any kind of like screening test we're using, any, not just screening test, diagnostic test, in order to come up with what's a positive answer and a negative answer, unless we're just looking for something, like I guess if you're checking someone's blood for bacteria, you don't really need a cutoff, right? It's either there or it's not.
Right.
But for a lot of other tests we do, we're using
more of a gray area.
Yeah, we're using a cutoff range. So to know what a normal hemoglobin level is, they went out and sampled hundreds of thousands of people in the population. They just took their blood and looked at what their hemoglobin was. And this fell into a bell curve, right? Are you familiar with that idea, Justin, a bell curve? Okay. And then they took the middle chunk of the bell curve and said, this is normal. And then everybody out on the tails
than this, you're done.
Isn't. Yeah. Right. And so like that's where we get these ranges. And so when any test that you're coming up against, if you're wondering like, well, why do we do it this specific way? It's because it was the way we did it when we first came up with the test. It's the way the test was standardized. And it's the only way that the test continues to work.
Because the data is dependent on this response, right?
Yes.
So you can't compare it to other people's responses because the input isn't standardized.
We gave somebody who didn't have diabetes, we gave them a 50 gram glucose load, and then we checked their blood sugar in an hour. And then we did that over and over and over and over and over again, and we came up with what that cutoff number is.
Right.
If you give somebody a pink drink from Starbucks, I don't know what their glucose level will predictably be in an hour. Mm-hmm. I could give you some basic ideas based on, we kind of know how the body handles a sugar load and how a diabetic versus non-diabetic person would handle that. We kind of have those ideas. But as far as like a perfect cutoff, of course I couldn't give you that because I never did a study where I gave a bunch of pregnant people pink drinks and then...
Not that you wrote down. I mean, you've done your own informal work.
I tried the pink drink actually after pregnancy because there was a rumor that it would help with breast milk production. I don't really know that that is true, but I did like the pink drink. So, you know, there was that.
You must not love the pink drink, though. I've never seen you order one ever again.
No, I prefer coffee. Anyway, so that is why we continued to do the test that way, is because back in 1964, when O'Sullivan first sort of wrote the cutoff values and everything that was diagnostic, this is how they did the test. There are different kinds of sugar in different beverages and foods and everything, right? There are lots of forms of sugar. And they will raise your blood glucose in slightly different ways,
okay,
to different levels and at different rates. And so... And plus, I don't know if you just say, like, I drank some Coke, how much, and that's a different kind of sugar, and exactly how, you know, how many hours or how many minutes have elapsed. Mm-hmm. I can't use that diagnostically. So people who are advocating for you to go against your doctor's orders and do the test sort of in your own way, you're not doing the test anymore.
Yes, you're just drinking something.
Yes, and so the data that your doctor gets to try to interpret will not mean anything. And the risk of that is that you may be diagnosed with gestational diabetes when you don't have it, or you may not be diagnosed with gestational diabetes when you do have it. And that's bad.
Yeah.
That for all the reasons we already talked about, because the mortality rate of gestational diabetes was very high for both the pregnant person and the baby prior to our ability to test for it, diagnose it, and then treat it with insulin. So anybody urging you not to do that. And now a lot of people point out there's been a lot of discourse through the years. We've had multiple like giant international workshops where they get experts, because basically we take all this data and then we get all of the experts together at a giant conference and make guidelines based on the data, right? The data doesn't always—
wild parties at that, just how chunky can a baby be conferences.
I bet, you know, that'd be interesting to know, like, how wild did different medical conferences based on the specialty get? These are OBGYN conferences. I don't know. I'm a family doctor.
Yeah.
Our conferences, like, everybody just assumes we, like, all wear Birks and have sing-alongs by the fire. And
I bet dermatologists get the wildest.
You think?
Everybody.
Dermatologists?
Everybody with perfect, touchably soft, creamy skin, the light reflecting off of it, and just so. Everybody's taking care of their look. Everybody looks great. Everybody looks phenomenal. It looks like friggin' Hunger Games. The rich people up there with their perfect skin. Incredible. Bunch of golds up there.
All right. I definitely think compared to a family doctor one, ours would be at a campsite. It would not be fancy.
Yeah.
Because we're all, we don't make that kind of money.
Orthopedists would be wild too, because they get drunk and they'd be like, I want to fix any bones.
I don't think they would get drunk. They take way too good care of themselves for that.
Okay.
They wouldn't drink. They'd be very well hydrated. They would all go. They'd all go jog together, and then they'd lift.
They get high on lactic acid. And then
yes.
Just start fixing bones.
Yes. They're healthier than we are. Anyway, so
not healthier than me. I review video games.
So they've held all these workshops through the years. I think this is important to bring up because, again, all of this stuff is nuanced and you can't just acknowledge one side or the other. We have reevaluated many times through the years from 1979 up to 2005. And then again, as of 2020, we've reevaluated all of these guidelines over and over and over again. And different countries do manage this differently. A lot of what I'm telling you is the way the United States has decided, you know, our medical organizations have standardized our care. There are other countries where they don't necessarily screen everybody based on the same criteria or at the same number of weeks. They look for different things. And the idea is there is a thought like, do you screen too much in the US? But there are other countries where we would argue you don't screen enough because you're missing people and you're not managing their diabetes. So there's definitely room for people who are well-intentioned and understand the data, who are experts in this field, to sit and discuss and debate what is the best way to take this screening tool and apply it appropriately so that we save as many lives as possible. That's like a conversation we have about everything in medicine. But currently, our best advice is do the test when your medical provider recommends you do the test, and do it in the way, certainly if you're going to do it the way that they tell you to. Cause otherwise, like, you've drunk some stuff, you got your blood drawn, maybe you paid for it cause it's the United States and we make you pay for medical care here. And if you did it wrong, it's meaningless and you've wasted your time and you got stuck with a needle for no reason. Like, what's the point? If you're going to do it right. And let me tell you, just do it.
Just do it.
Do the test. It's good to know.
Maybe we can maybe they'll have banana. You never know. Maybe they'll have banana.
I don't know what flavors they have. Mine was orange. But before we had this amazing medical advance, the glucose tolerance test and insulin to manage diabetes, before that, a lot of people died unnecessarily. So that's why we do it. I think that's probably the best reason to do something in medicine.
I agree.
Because it prevents death.
That's actually the first day. They're like, why do we do all this? You may be asking. Well, to prevent death.
As we possibly can.
Thank you so much. Good job, Sid. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. We hope you've enjoyed yourself. We hope that you'll have a wonderful rest of your week. Thanks to the taxpayers for the use of their song Medicines as the intro and outro of our program. And thanks to you for listening. That's going to do it for us this week on Sawbones. Until next time, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
Maximum Fun,
a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows,
supported
directly
by you.